building for the third or fourth time, and I realize she's expecting Mordan to follow her out.
What do you mean?
Asks Seb uneasily. She shrugs. The best outcome is that they find who did it and put them away. Then it's all neatly wrapped up. Otherwise, she shrugs again, it's never really over. Even if they consign it to the cold case pile, it could still come alive again. New evidence, new political pressure to take another look. Her words cause another blanket of silence to fall heavily on the group. She's probably quoting Mordan, I think, uneasily. How many cases has he worked on that end up like that? Never resolved, but never entirely forgotten, either.
Well, I have to get back to the office, says Caro abruptly. Can I drop anyone at Westminster Tube on the way past?
It's presented as a general offer, but she's looking directly at Seb when she says it.
Sounds good, he says, after a pause.
Best head that way to get a cab, Tom says, pointing. I'll call you later, Seb, okay?
Normally, we would all accompany our goodbyes with some kind of physical display. But today, Seb simply lifts a tired hand in salute, and Caro takes his other arm, calling over her shoulder.
See you all soon. In fact, see you tomorrow, Kate.
Oh, joy.
See you then,
I say sweetly. Tom watches them go, a frown between his eyebrows. Is he worried about Seb's behaviour or Caro's? And for whose welfare is he concerned, his own or someone else's? A movement in my peripheral vision pulls my head round, and I see Mordan making his way across to Lara, who has moved a couple of paces away from Tom and me. Her gaze is fixed on Mordan, but her expression is unexpectedly conflicted.
I'll call you later, Lara, I offer, presuming she will leave with him.
She glances at me swiftly, shaking her head.
No, wait for me. Please, wait.
Okay. I'm slightly nonplussed. Tom takes my arm and pulls me aside so we are partially hidden by a tree, his eyes fixed on the pair.
What?
I start to say, but he shushes me. I realize I am as close to Tom as I was in the corridor that night, close enough to smell his aftershave. It makes me absurdly self-conscious. I turn my head quickly and focus on Mordan and Lara. The detective must have seen us on his route to Lara, but the tree cover does give the illusion that they have some privacy, and in truth, I can only pick out the odd syllable from what they are saying. Lara is doing the bulk of the talking, in a low, earnest tone, spots of colour visible in her cheeks. She's trying not to cry, I realize. Something she says cuts at Mordan. He flinches and interrupts urgently, reaching a long arm out to her, but she shakes her head resolutely and takes a step back. It finally dawns on me what I'm watching, and I instantly feel grubby, but it's impossible to look away. Mordan tries to make his point again, frustration clear in every line of his long frame, but Lara is resolute. She must be resolute to hold firm in the face of the heart-rending misery that slowly steals over Mordan's face. I don't look at Tom. If he were to display any pleasure at all at this outcome, I might actually punch him. Then Lara is walking toward us in short, quick steps, the colour still high in her cheeks. Her eyes are remarkably dry. Oh, honey. I step out from the tree as I speak and move to hug her. But she gives a quick shake of her head, and I realize she will fall apart if I do. Come back to mine. Let's find a cab. She nods. Tom reaches out a hand and touches her cheek briefly.
I'm sorry, he says, with what seems like genuine empathy.
He looks like he has more to add, but he checks himself. Her face crumples briefly at that, but she catches herself. I link an arm through hers just as Tom spots a taxi and hails it for us. Lara climbs in first. I glance down the street and see that Mordan is still standing there, his long face indescribably bleak. I look away hurriedly and move to follow Lara, but Tom stops me, gesturing me toward the front of the cab, out of earshot of Lara.
We need to talk, he says decisively, looking me straight in the eye for possibly the first time today.
I know. I feel relieved almost to tears to have him make the first move. I mean, I can't right now, what with Lara, but I am so sorry.
He cuts me off with a sharp, flat chop of one hand.
Not about that.
My face freezes, and something flickers in his eyes.
I don't mean... Look, I know we do, but not now. I meant we need to talk about the case. Severine.
Right.
God forbid I should put our friendship higher up the priority list. Only, that's strange, isn't it? Because according to you, I don't care a jot.
I know I'm lashing out. I know it's destructive. But I'm hurt. I'm hurt and he did the hurting, and I can't just put it aside.
Kate, he says, running an exasperated hand through his hair. Don't think I don't appreciate the biting sarcasm, but we just don't have time for it. This, the car, it changes everything. It, not now, Tom. I'm going home to take care of Lara.
I turn away and start climbing into the taxi.
Tomorrow, then, he insists, through the open door.
Whatever. I pull the door sharply shut and give the driver my address.
I had to do it.
The words spill out of Lara as soon as we are underway.
It was fine when it wasn't real, when none of us were really under suspicion. But it's not a game anymore, is it? Success for him is finding enough evidence to arrest one of us. Me? Well, probably not me, but maybe you. Or Tom, or Seb, or Caro. I can't spend time with him wondering if something I say, something completely inconsequential to me, might make all the difference to him. I can't be part of that. I can't. I can't.
Her blue eyes are swimming now. Her breaths are shuddering gasps, and the tears are starting to stream down her cheeks. I pull her into a hug, not the easiest thing in a moving cab, and she sobs into my neck in painful, body-racking gulps.
Oh, honey, I say helplessly, past the lump in my own throat. I'm so proud of you.
It's true. Having seen firsthand exactly how giddy and reckless Mordan makes her, I'm in awe of the strength she has just displayed. I wonder if I would be able to do the same, but I can't quite put myself in her shoes. Was I ever as swept away by Seb as she is by Mordan? The memories are there to suggest it, but they don't recreate the feeling within me. I say again,
I'm so proud of you. You chose to protect your friends from him.
After a moment, I add blackly, though on balance, I'm starting to think that maybe he can have them all except you.
You don't mean that.
Her gasped words are muffled by my now damp collar.
No, I suppose not, I concede with a sigh. Except maybe...
Caro, she finishes for me. And for a moment we are both laughing as well as crying, and I think perhaps she's going to be all right, after all. I call my lawyer first thing the next morning, though it's mid-morning before she gets back to me. Thankfully Paul is out of the office, so I am free to talk uninhibitedly. She listens intently to my account of the meeting, and asks a couple of pertinent questions before she gives her verdict.
He's got more up his sleeve, she says in her usual decisive manner. That the girl on the CCTV isn't Severine. Well, it was never a given that it was. That's not a game-changer.
So he has more. He wouldn't still be here without it. Do you think any of the others will speak to him without a lawyer?
I don't know. I think about it. Not Lara, I don't think. Not anymore. And not Seb. Probably not Caro either, unless she's playing some angle that I can't foresee.
Tom?
I don't know about Tom.
Probably not, but I don't know for sure. I imagine her tapping her teeth with her fingernail, hopefully whilst wearing a less garish lipstick. A soft taupe, perhaps.
Obviously what I said before still stands. You mustn't allow yourself to be questioned without me present. But the trick is to appear cooperative. Antagonizing the police is never a good strategy.
Appear cooperative. I stress the first word with an ironic twist.
She laughs. Well, yes, appear. If you actually happen to be cooperative too, that's fine, but not actually necessary.
She pauses and I sense the shift of gear. The moment for humor has passed.
Have you thought any more about what happened on that Friday night? If there was some piece of information, however small, that you hadn't mentioned before, you could come forward with it. With me present, I hasten to add, which would go a long way to demonstrating cooperation.
Or demonstrating a desire to shift blame.
I wouldn't worry about that. Believe me, right now the lawyers for all of your little band will be advising their clients to shift the blame.
She waits to allow her words their full impact.
So, she finally continues, is there anything you can think of, anything at all that you haven't mentioned?
I'm silent. There's so much I haven't mentioned, both from that night and since. The smuggled cocaine and subsequent blazing row. Caro and Seb's recent conspiratorial assignations. Tom's continual absence of surprise, apart from during last night's meeting. Mordan and Lara's relationship.
I'll need to spend some time thinking about that, I say at last.
You do that.
Her voice has hardened. There's a warning note in it. I haven't fooled her at all.
I can't help you if I don't have all the facts. I don't want you bringing up things at the 11th hour when you're already under arrest.
I'm temporarily unable to breathe.
Arrest? I croak when I finally find my voice. Is that likely?
Well, not off the current known facts, but as we've already discussed, Mordan must have something more up his sleeve. He isn't here for nothing.
Right. I rub my forehead.
Right.
I think we should meet again and go over everything once more.
Her voice has softened a little.
My assistant will call you to set something up. In the meantime, promise me you'll rack your brains about that evening.
I will.
I promise.
One would think I would have dwelled on little else since yesterday, but last night Lara's emotional state had required a certain amount of dedicated focus. And if I'm honest, I've always shied away from memories of that week. But now the stakes are growing, day by day it seems. I should approach this as I would a problem with my company, I think. I should set aside time to apply dedicated thought. I look at my online calendar for today and decisively block out 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. I can't think of what to put in the subject box, so I mark it private so that Julie can't see the content and leave the subject blank, which in retrospect strikes me as highly ironic, marking an appointment private to hide the fact it says nothing at all. Then I wonder who else is speaking to their lawyer and setting aside thinking time. And it doesn't seem at all funny anymore. By happy coincidence, Gordon is hurrying through the Hafton Weil lobby just as I swing in through the revolving doors, a small frown and his short, quick steps betraying the time pressure he's under. Nevertheless, he stops when he sees me, and the frown clears.
Kate, he says, shaking my hand, I've been meaning to call you.
He takes my arm and draws me aside, out of the way of the revolving door traffic.
I'm so sorry I didn't get the opportunity to explain to you in person the change of spearhead at our end. That was...
He pauses, and for a moment I see the legendary Farrow steel in his eyes.
Well, that was badly done.
I'm absurdly pleased that he's annoyed with Caro, for once not because it's Caro, but because he understands the lack of respect implied by that episode. He lowers his voice and continues.
The idea of putting her in charge actually came from your suggestion of finding her some management initiatives to get involved with. So thank you for that. Though I have to say, I'm going to miss our little meetings.
He smiles a little ruefully.
Me too, I say honestly. It's been a real pleasure.
His eyes crinkle at the edges, then he glances at his watch.
But you're on your way to something. I am anxious not to impose. Don't let me keep you.
I'm sorry, I do hate to say hi and bye. Actually, what are you doing for lunch today?
Caro invited me to have a bite with her after our meeting.
He brightens.
Excellent, I'll gatecrash.
I laugh. And if she cancels lunch on you, which is rather likely, she's under the cosh on something big right now, and I can't imagine she's getting much sleep, let alone time to eat properly. Then you won't be left in the lurch. Perfect, he says, with a satisfied air. See you then.
He turns away, tossing a smile over his shoulder. And I think that I can't see a single atom of him that resembles Caro. And neither can I see an ounce of Gordon in Caro when she joins me in the meeting room. Basement this time, no spectacular view. In fact, no view at all. After a wait that's only been long enough for me to pour a cup of coffee from the attendant's silver flask. She does indeed look tired, even more so than at last night's meeting. The shadows under her eyes have deepened. And she's even paler, though that might actually be the effect of the rather stark, though very sharp, black trouser suit she's wearing. We greet each other with air kisses, and then I say, I saw your dad in the lobby. He's planning to gatecrash our lunch. She shakes her head, rolling her eyes. Shameless man, though since I'm waiting on a call from New York, which will of course come just as we're sitting down to eat, I might be best leaving the two of you to it. She pulls out a seat, snags a biscuit, and takes a bite of it in what seems like one continuous movement. Caro is running purely on adrenaline, I realize. He did say you're rather snored under at the moment. She nods vehemently as she finishes her mouthful. A rather full-on hostile bid. I haven't been home to my flat since I saw you yesterday. She raises her eyebrows ruefully. You remember how it is during the crazy times. If you get home at all, it's never before midnight, and on the odd occasion that you do, there's a stack of laundry to get through and bills to pay, and you have no inclination to do either. It's an odd sensation to be feeling sorry for Caro. I don't enjoy it, but I do remember exactly what she describes. Before I left the practice of law, I did everything that is expected of a lowly associate. And what is expected is to give your all your time, all your energy, all your social life. All is consumed by the beast that is the modern top-tier corporate law firm. I remember the late nights in a deserted office, when even the aircon had stopped working, and the air grew still and heavy and hot. I remember strip lighting and the faint glow from the few computer screens still on, and eyes so tired and scratchy that I could barely read my monitor. The adrenaline rushes occurred in the day, fueled by the enthusiasm of the other team members, but the real hard graft usually happened at night, alone or perhaps with one colleague, with no more camaraderie on tap to spur you on. Mostly I remember the sense of disjointment, of being outside of everything, outside of the firm, where I could never quite belong, outside of my circle of friends whose social life didn't halt but went on happily without me. Outside of my very own life. I left the practice of law for reasons that had nothing to do with the working hours, and in starting up Channing Associates, I've been no stranger to long days that bleed into nights, and weeks that spread a stain into weekends. But I wonder how I would cope with 110-hour weeks now. I suppose the period before partnership is even more brutal, I respond neutrally. Typically, candidates continue to work at the same breakneck pace, but with the added stress of continual scrutiny of every single decision they take, every strategy they suggest. Her face tightens a fraction. I suspect Caro is aware her campaign is not going perfectly. But she simply says, "Yes," then busies herself selecting another biscuit. I remember that, too. The diabolic diet that comes from having lost all sense of normal body rhythm, leaving you lurching from one sugar fix to another. After a moment, she adds, "At any rate, I think I'm going to be stuck here all week, and all weekend too." "Did you have plans?" "I was going to visit my mum, but..." She shrugs ruefully. "Do you see her much?" I ask, genuinely curious. She shakes her head. A small economical movement. "I always think I should go down more." She grimaces, but not without humour. "Right up to the point when I'm there. And then I rather think the opposite." That pulls a chuckle from me. "You don't get along?" She shrugs again. "It's a well-trodden path. Things start well,
but sooner or later the criticisms will come out. She didn't want me to become a lawyer, you see, but I always wanted to follow Dad into the law. She can't see the point of me working so hard when surely I could marry money or live off Dad's. She trails off and grimaces again. But the humor is gone. She seems suddenly defenseless. And for the first time ever, I can imagine the 13-year-old girl that she once was, trying to navigate through the trials of teenage life with a mother she can never please, who is using her as a tool against the father she longs to emulate. I think of my own mother, a geriatric nurse, gently proud, but benignly uncomprehending both of the job that I do and why I would want to do it, given the stress and long hours. It was always my father who understood. For the first time ever, I want to reach out to Carol, but I have no idea how. Anyway, she says briskly, breaking the moment, I certainly could have done without having to sprint across to New Scotland Yard last night. She eyes me across the table as she takes a neat bite, her small sharp teeth gleaming white. Perhaps she's had them bleached. She's the Carol I expect once again, but that moment has shaken me. I can still feel the reverberations. Perhaps beneath the brittle painted surface of Carol, there are other versions, stacked like Russian dolls, years upon years of them, right back to the vulnerable girl that she must have been at the time of the divorce. And beyond, all of them inside her. Perhaps I should take more care with the shell. What did you make of all of that yesterday? I grimace, looking for a non-committal answer. I'm not sure I understand why Mordan hasn't given up and gone home. It doesn't seem like there's anything to support any one of us as a suspect, over anyone else who happened to be in the vicinity. She nods vigorously as she finishes her mouthful. Totally. Completely agree. She adds, almost as an afterthought, which makes it weird that he keeps asking me about Theo.
Really?
God, yes, like a dog with a bone. And what can I say? I mean, we were together until we went up to our beds, and then... She waves a hand airily. It's not a gesture that suits her. It's too vague, and Carol is never vague. Well, then I was asleep. And who can vouch for anyone when they're asleep? Well, that applies to us all, I say tightly. There must have been a couple of hours when everyone was asleep and no one is accounted for. Except for Lara and Tom, entwined in coital bliss. Absolutely, of course. Which makes it odd that he's focusing on Theo particularly. She shrugs. Though, distasteful as it is to say, if it had to be one of us. I stare at her, not so much appalled as bewildered. Does she not know Tom at all? Surely she realizes he would fight ceaselessly to prevent any besmirching of Theo's name. She shrugs again. Well, onward and upward. Why don't you give me an overview of where we stand with the candidates? So I do, and we discuss. The process is extremely developed by now. There's not a lot she can add. Her questions are professional and intelligent. Though she is clearly far more focused on immediate benefits to the firm from prospective new hires, rather than their career development within the company, which is not quite the message Gordon would be sending candidates. I will have to be careful she doesn't ruin the groundwork we've laid. I make a couple of careful allusions to it that are obviously less subtle than intended. After the second one, she stops and laughs. Kate! She says through a smile that holds genuine amusement. Don't worry. I know how to stay on message. I won't scare the horses. I know, of course not. It's just that collegiality and long-term career opportunities are the main reason a couple of these candidates are considering this place. I get it. Don't worry. She puts down her pen and yawns, half-heartedly covering her mouth. The adrenaline has been slowly leaching out of her during our meeting. And the yawns are coming closer together. Oh, she says suddenly, brightening a little. I meant to tell you, you may get a call from a chap called Hugh Brompton at Stockley's. Stockley's is an enormously successful, mid-tier UK firm with a footprint just about everywhere. It doesn't compete with Haft & Wile, as it wouldn't generally get the cutting-edge, high-profile deals,
but there's an awful lot of work around that isn't cutting edge or high profile. We use them quite a bit when we need to outsource some of the drudge work, much cheaper for the client than Haft and Weil personnel. She's watching me carefully as she speaks, her head slightly cocked and her tired eyes gleaming bird-like. Anyway, they're looking to beef up certain areas, and I told Hugh about you and suggested they give you a call. It's a big job, from what he says, and the contract is basically yours. As far as he's concerned, if you're good enough for Haft and Weil, you're good enough for him. I'm temporarily floored. Then I say, thank you. Because of course I can't say anything else, but inside I'm scrabbling around to figure out the angle. Because of course there's an angle, and if I don't know what it is, then I'm exactly where she wants me. Or at least, that's how it would be for the Caro I thought I knew. But perhaps this Caro is something different. I adopt a smile that's at least half genuine. That's kind of you. Very much appreciated. Well, we're in business together, and business partners help each other out. Her eyes gleam and she has a self-satisfied smile as she adds slyly, I told you I could stay on message. I laugh, both out of surprise and because her wicked little dig is genuinely funny, and for a moment I see her as she may well be, or perhaps I see her as Seb and Tom see her, a clever, sharply witty, fearless woman. I can't tell if what she's presenting now is only part of the picture, or if the picture has changed. It leaves me uneasily off-kilter. Her mobile goes off and she takes the call with a quick apology, firing out a series of short responses and checking her watch while she paces the room. Sorry, she says with a grimace when she hangs up. That call from New York is going to happen in 10 minutes. I'm afraid you and Gordon will be on your own for lunch. No problem. We exit the windowless room into an equally windowless passageway. You know, I say conversationally, I always wondered why you joined your father's law firm. You could have gone to any number of competitors, I'm sure. Oh, sure, she says offhand as we climb a sweeping glass and metal staircase to the main lobby, where I find myself blinking, somehow surprised at the daylight. But it's lunchtime. Of course there is daylight. But Haft and Weil was really the best opportunity for me. You can't do better than best in class, after all. Bravo, I say, raising my eyebrows with a half-smile. Once again, admirably on message. She lays a hand on my upper arm and laughs, a genuine laugh, and it softens her. Her sharp edges become impish rather than cutting. I told you I could. She looks over my shoulder, still smiling, then exclaims, Right on time. Here's Gordon. You know, I probably see more of him now than I did growing up, what with the divorce and boarding school and all. She smiles a hello over my shoulder at him, and then shakes my hand, quick and firm, cordially professional. I'll leave you in his capable hands. You two have a lovely lunch. We will, Gordon says, smiling at her. Then he turns and ushers me through the lobby. Looks like you two are getting on famously, he remarks, and it suddenly crosses my mind that perhaps Caro knew he was there and staged that little tableau, the laugh, the little touch. And then I realize how loathsomely paranoid I've become, and I hate myself for it. Chapter 15. The designated thinking hour arrives and departs without a single moment spent in contemplation. Because Hugh Brompton does indeed call, and the job in question is dynamite, the kind of contract that really establishes a new firm. But of course, they want our strategies and suggestions at a meeting tomorrow afternoon. So Paul and I work late, eating takeout sushi at our desks, and mainly ignoring our mobiles. Actually mainly ignoring Paul's mobile, judging from the number of times it rings, he either has a very active social life, or an extremely jealous girlfriend. In contrast, mine rings only twice. The first call is Lara, and I take it to quickly check how she's holding up. The second is from Tom. Do you need to take that? Asks Paul, and I realize I'm staring at the mobile screen as it rings. No, I say brightly, as I reach over to hit the reject button.
I can deal with it later. A moment later the phone beeps with a voicemail alert. I deliberately ignore it and turn back to Paul. Where were we? Oh yes, do you think we're promising too much with this timeline? It's 1 in the morning before I climb into a cab and settle in the back, glancing at my phone out of habit. A tiny red alert reminds me I have a voicemail. I play the message, and Tom's deep baritone greets me.
Hi, Kate, it's Tom.
A pause.
We really do need to talk about the case. Are you able to come round after you finish work? I'll be home, so just give me a call whenever...
He sounds uneasy, awkward even.
Well, give me a call.
It hardly credits belief that a single drunken kiss can reduce years of friendship to dodged calls and stilted voicemails. I stare out of the cab window in a state of torpid exhaustion and watch London slide by, lit patchily by garish neon signs and street lamps that deliver a stark, pale light without colour or warmth. After a moment I pick up my phone again and type out a text message. Been working late, big pitch tomorrow afternoon. I can drop by after work tomorrow. K. X. I read it over again before sending. K. X is my habitual sign-off with Tom, but now every character is fraught with meaning and open to misinterpretation. I remove the X. The presentation to Stockley's goes well. Paul is a good presenter, suave and relaxed, and he thinks well on his feet. His style is a good complement to my own direct approach. Carol was right. The contract was ours to lose, and by the time we are shaking hands and saying goodbye, I know we haven't done that. Paul hails a cab and we jump in and animatedly dissect the meeting on the trip back to the office.
One thing I meant to ask you, Paul says, as he waits on the pavement for me to pay the cabbie.
There's an odd note in his voice that makes me glance over at him. His almost translucent eyebrows are drawn together in a frown.
What?
I turn back to the cab driver to collect my change.
Well, Mark Jeffers, the Clifford Chance associate.
That's the one.
Well, he asked me if I was in line for a promotion.
I look at him blankly, not understanding. If he's angling for more money, this is an odd approach. The cab driver has pulled away, leaving the two of us together on the street by our office, but neither of us moves toward the doorway.
When you get arrested.
What the fuck? My mind is racing. How in the world did Mark Jeffers get hold of this? And how many other people has he spread this gossip to? This sort of rumor could cut off a fledgling company at the knees, even more than most companies. A recruitment firm's only asset is its people and their reputation.
He smiles in a thin line. Actually, that's exactly what I said. But he said he had it on good authority that you're under investigation for a murder, of all things. In France or something. I told him he needs to get better sources.
He looks at me uneasily.
If there was anything to it, you'd have told me about it, right?
I take a deep breath. This will need careful handling.
I am not under investigation, I say robustly. A girl went missing from the next-door farmhouse when a group of us were in France on holiday 10 years ago. Her body turned up recently.
Turned up? Was found. I see her again, the bones in a crumpled pile, ghostly white in the dim underground light.
In a well, actually,
I admit, the word somehow slipping out.
Jesus, Kate, and you're just telling me this now?
He's building up a head of righteous anger. I need to stomp on that quickly.
Come on, Paul, it's nothing.
I make a show of impatience, stamping on the guilt that rises as I ostensibly belittle Severine's death. I carry on defiantly.
Since the six of us were the last people to see her alive, obviously the police want to talk to us again. But that's all it is. I can assure you, I'm not about to be arrested.
I throw all my powers of persuasion into the eye contact we're sharing, and hope to high heaven that every word I've said is true.
You should have told me. The last thing we need is any kind of stain on our name. You know how people think, no smoke without fire. Rubbish. We have a contract from Hafton Weil, and now one with Stockley's. That's what clients will focus on, and those kinds of firms don't employ headhunters under investigation for murder. This is just industry gossip that will be forgotten the minute some senior partner gets caught shagging his secretary.
Perhaps.
He's almost mollified. His anger has switched into sulkiness. If it's nothing, then why didn't you mention it?
Does he have a point?
We're partners in a business together. We see each other every working day. Would it have been normal to have mentioned this to him?
I suppose so, especially if there was any chance of it impacting the business.
Except I never thought that there was. Once again, I wonder how the hell Mark Jeffers got hold of this. None of our names have ever been in the papers, except Theo's parents as owners of the farmhouse.
Because? I take another deep breath, and this time I tell him the absolute truth.
Because I don't like talking about it. She was a family friend of the guy we were staying with. We practically spent all week with her. And then she... I trail off.
I'm sorry. I should have told you.
Though it simply didn't cross my mind to discuss it with anyone. I wonder how many people Lara has spoken to about it. Or Seb, or Tom, or Caro.
Oh. Paul is chastened. The personal impact didn't quite occur to him.
No, I'm sorry. That must have been awful. He touches my arm awkwardly, and I find a weak smile for him, appreciative of the gesture. I know I'm too comfortable being a solitary creature, but for the first time I realize that in an office of three, where we work long hours, that means I'm forcing solitude on Paul too, who is definitely not naturally suited to it. I should make more of an effort to be social with him and Julie.
Come on, I say, turning for our office. Let's go find Stockley some candidates.
I look for Severine as we enter the office, almost unable to believe that she wouldn't have wanted to eavesdrop on that little scene with Paul. But she's not lounging at my desk, as I'm expecting. I was hoping to see her, I realize. To...
what?
To apologize? To tell her that I'm sorry, but I'm fighting to keep Paul's morale intact, and that's more important than hurting the feelings of the ghost who haunts me?
Still, she was murdered. It's not nothing. That's what bothers me more than anything, that whoever did it might get away with it. And that would make it seem as if it doesn't matter, as if Severine never mattered. Because if our world continues without a hitch, then we might as well be condoning it. And we don't. I don't. It's not nothing.
Back at my desk, the first thing I do is reschedule the thinking time. Tom's flat. I loiter outside and try not to think about the last time I was here. I'm waiting for Lara. At the last minute I chickened out and called in the cavalry. And in truth, Lara should be here too. She's already shown her colours by overthrowing Mordan, and Tom has made it perfectly clear he only wants to talk about the case. Though I haven't failed to notice the desperate, clichéd irony of my support system being exactly the person Tom wants instead of me, which is why I need the support in the first place. Lara appears from the direction of the tube station in a powder blue dress, her blonde locks lit luminous red gold by the evening sun that bleeds red ribbons of cloud across the horizon. Severine is beside her, walking barefoot with a loose feline grace in the familiar black shift dress, her hair wrapped in the red chiffon scarf. Her sandals are dangling from one finger. I walk down to meet them, marveling at the tableau they present with the setting sun behind them. Lara and Severine, one light, one dark. Are these two really all I can trust in the world?
How are you, honey? I ask as I hug her.
It's not a pleasantry. I pull back to search her face as she casts around for an answer.
Okay, she says, with a slight rueful twist to her lips. She looks a touch pale, and she's wearing less makeup than usual, but her cornflower eyes are clear with no telltale red rims.
Not great,
but okay. We head back toward Tom's flat, chatting about this and that. She's Lara, but a dimmed version. I can't feel her usual vibrancy, and the lack of it makes me ache for her. At the bottom of the steps, I can delay no longer, and I stop her for a moment. One thing I've been meaning to ask.
What?
She prompts as I hesitate. That night in the farmhouse, with Tom, was there ever a time you were apart? And, well, did you sleep?
She assesses me shrewdly, her eyes narrowing.
You're trying to figure out if it could have been Tom.
I'm just looking at every angle,
I say stiffly. I honored the thinking hour this time, and this question is one of the consequences.
What about me, then?
She challenges. There's a wild light in her eye that I don't recognize.
If you're willing to accuse Tom, why not me?
Of course it wasn't you.
Why not?
The light flares into anger.
Why does nobody consider me? Pretty, vacuous Lara. She's not even capable of a murder. Best not trouble her pretty little head with all of that.
I look at her in astonishment. I know this is tied up with Mordan somehow, but I'm not quite sure how to navigate it.
Well, okay then, tell me. Did you murder Severine?
Of course not, she says, the anger suddenly leaving her.
I couldn't possibly do such a thing.
The absurdity strikes us both at the same time, and we start to giggle. When the last bubbles of laughter have died out, I say quietly,
It's not a bad thing, Lara. You're full of light. You think the best of everyone. We all see it. It draws us in. But nobody thinks you're vacuous.
She inclines her head a little ruefully, not entirely accepting my words.
Did Mordan say something to you?
Are you still talking to him? I ask cautiously.
I doubt it after our last conversation, she says frankly. He thinks I'm going to go off and screw half the men in London. The half I haven't already screwed, that is.
She shakes her head in frustration.
When he asked before about past boyfriends, I was honest. More fool me. I didn't expect to have it thrown back in my face. And aren't the French supposed to be more liberal than the British on that sort of thing?
I'm sure Frenchmen are just as susceptible to jealousy as British men. Poor Mordan. He must be incredibly cut up to lash out like that. He doesn't strike me as a man who usually makes such appalling missteps.
Are you? Going to screw half of London, I mean?
Only maybe someone should warn the poor creatures, give them time to prepare.
Stop it! She says, laughing again. That was then.
She sobers and puts a hand on my arm, earnestness shining out of her.
I'm different now.
I know, I say gently, though a shameful part of me wonders how long she will be different for. But I realize I'm being unfair. Surely we're all different now, from how we were in a French farmhouse a decade ago. Perhaps it just took a little longer for the impact to hit Lara. A slight frown crosses her face.
You don't believe me.
I do, I reassure her quickly. Of course I do. I was just contrasting with that week in France. She cocks her head questioningly. I try to find the right words.
I mean, we're all different now. Even Carol, maybe. Everyone is different or gone. Or maybe I'm seeing different sides of everyone. When I tried to think about what might have happened to Severine, it's like trying to solve a puzzle based on the picture on the box, but the pieces have evolved. Or maybe the picture on the box was never the right picture in the first place.
Lara still has her head cocked to one side, the quizzical look still in place. I shake my head.
Never mind. Come on, we should go up.
We link arms and turn toward the entrance to Tom's block of flats. Lara buzzes to announce us. I hear Tom's voice through the intercom, made tinny and weak. If he's surprised at Lara's presence, it doesn't show. Other than perhaps through a slight pause before he speaks, that could instead have been a result of the technology.
I never answered your question, though, Lara says, as we start to climb the threadbare stairs.
We weren't apart that I was aware of, except to go to the loo, but we did sleep. I don't know how long for, maybe just a couple of hours? Tom has left the door of his flat ajar. We push through, and despite my now numerous visits, it still surprises me to see this oasis of light and modern style, after the genteel shabbiness of the common areas. Following noise, we find him hunting down some wine glasses in the kitchen.
"I presume a glass of wine wouldn't go amiss, ladies," he says with a grin, raising the bottle of white in his hand.
He's had time to change after work. He's wearing jeans and a blue t-shirt that picks up the color in his eyes.
"Now that's what I call a welcome."
Lara smiles flirtatiously as she kisses him hello. I glance away, and thus am completely unprepared when he wraps his arms around me in his bear hug of old. The t-shirt is of the softest cotton, and he smells of the same aftershave from that dark, delicious corridor. For a moment, the ache is blinding. When I pull myself together enough to return the hug, I think I hear the stroke of his warm breath deliver, "Sorry," into my ear. When he releases me, I stare after him, trying to search his eyes, but he busies himself hunting down a corkscrew. And then Lara pulls out a bar stool for me, and I'm left wondering what just happened as I settle beside her on one side of the kitchen counter. Tom is facing us, the dark granite kitchen counter between us.
"So, what news?"
he says, uncorking the bottle.
He's meeting my eyes from time to time, but I'm failing to divine anything from his expression.
The bar stool is an uncomfortable height. I can't rest my elbows on the counter, and my feet don't reach the floor, yet there's no strut for them to rest on. I feel perched and precarious. I shrug, leaving Lara to fill the gap.
"Not much," she says lightly. "I've turned celibate, and Kate is trying to figure out whether you could have killed Severin."
She's being flippant, of course she's being flippant, but Tom pauses in the act of pouring, his eyes leaping to mine.
"And?" he asks after a beat, placing the bottle carefully down and maintaining the eye contact.
It's clear he's completely disregarding the celibacy comment. Whether that will irk Lara or not, I don't know or care, because I currently feel like killing her for putting me in this position. I can feel her shifting uneasily beside me as it dawns on her that her comment is actually being taken seriously.
"Do you think I'm capable of it?"
Tom asks in a measured tone. It feels like a challenge, though over what, I'm not sure. Still, I rise to it.
"Yes,"
I say simply.
"Kate!"
I hear Lara exclaim, but I'm still locked in a gaze with Tom. There's nothing I can read in his eyes. Then he inclines his head a little and returns to pouring the wine.
"I'm not saying he did,"
I explain in an aside to Lara, though my eyes keep darting back to Tom, looking for something, anything that tells me what he's thinking. I try to hook one ankle round the leg of the stool, searching for some balance. I need an anchor.
"I'm just saying he's capable of it, under the right circumstances."
I take a sip of the wine that Tom has pushed toward me. "Probably all of us are, under the right circumstances."
"Not all, I don't think," says Tom thoughtfully.
He has a beer instead. He takes a long pull of it.
"Well, maybe everyone is capable of an accidental murder," he concedes. "But the cover-up, that's the crucial bit. Not everyone would have the self-possession to do that, rather than calling the emergency services."
"You would," I think immediately. Then I realize he's watching me, and have the uncomfortable feeling he can read my mind as he smiles thinly and raises his beer in a mock toast.
"Well," says Lara, after a pause, "we've certainly bypassed the small talk this evening."
She picks up her own wine and takes a long draught.
"Have either of you eaten?" asks Tom abruptly. "I've already warmed the oven. Shall I shove some pizzas in or something?"
The process of deliberating over the food options dispels the atmosphere. For a few moments this might be simply a social evening.
but once the oven door has been swung shut, Tom takes another swig of his beer, and I see him change gear.
Right, he says decisively, looking at Lara and me in turn. I think it's cards on the table time now. What do you guys think happened that night?
My cards are on the table, Lara complains. They've always been on the table. I never thought it was one of us.
She spreads her hands wide in exasperation, almost knocking over her glass.
Oops, sorry. I already had a glass or two after work with some colleagues. Anyway, so, unless you, Tom, manage to kill Severine, get rid of her body, clean yourself up, and get back into bed with me in the space of a little more than an hour, maybe two, then I have absolutely no information.
I'm taken aback by the casual way in which she can mention being in bed with Tom. With Tom. In public. To Tom himself. Without an iota of a blush. I glance at him quickly, but he doesn't appear fazed in the slightest.
I'm good, he says with dark humour. But not that good.
I try to stamp down my swelling sense of injustice. That Lara, who casually slept with him then tossed him aside, gets entirely forgiven. Yet I am held out to dry for a mere kiss. But there's a thread of irritation that leaks through into my words.
But you're presuming the same person did it all, I declare bluntly. It's possible more than one person was involved. Maybe an accidental killing by one, then one or two more involved in the cover-up.
This discussion is so abstract, so passionless, that it's hard to remember the girl it relates to. I glance around for her, but she's not in attendance. I feel an extra prickle of irritation. What kind of ghost wouldn't be interested in discussions on their own death? Though I suppose it's not as if she doesn't know the punchline. Tom nods. Somehow I feel an unexpected sense of approval from him.
Sounds like you have a theory.
No, I just...
I shift awkwardly on the very awkward stool. I don't have a theory. I have a collection of disquieting observations that add up to a maelstrom of unease, but nothing that could be called a theory.
Lara shifts herself so she's half lolling on the counter and cocks her head in sympathetic listening mode.
It's just us, Kate.
Come on, Kate, says Tom.
He's standing with his hands on the granite surface, leaning toward me. With his height, the body language sends a curious message of encouragement, mixed with intimidation.
You have to trust someone.
I look across at him, meeting those familiar blue eyes that are Tom's, not Seb's, above that unmistakable nose, and I am suddenly so blindingly angry with him that for a moment I can't speak. I used to trust him, I even want to trust him, so why won't he let me? He knows something, I know it. And by now he must realize I know it, given Lara's comment. Yet he won't let me in. And now I wonder if he's Tom, if he ever was the Tom I thought I knew, and if I got that wrong, what else have I been mistaken on? A cold fear is twisting my insides, and a raw anger spears through my throat at Tom. Tom, for putting it there.
Really?
I say bitingly, when I recover my voice. I have to trust someone.
That's rich. Who do you trust, Tom?
The only damn things that I'm sure of in this whole macabre debacle are that Seb and Caro are hiding something, and you know a hell of a lot more than you're letting on. Yet somehow, it's my life that's getting trampled on. So if we're talking about trust, how about we start with you, Tom?
Tom's eyes are widened in surprise at my attack. I catch a glimpse of Lara staring at me, completely nonplussed. And it halts me. I bite off the vitriolic torrent that's just gaining momentum. If I let it free, I may never stop. I grab my wine glass and focus on it determinedly in the suffocating silence that follows my words, while the remaining anger subsides along with my breathing, leaving me in acute danger of bursting into tears. The immediate urge to apologize for my un-British outburst is offset by a streak of rebellion fueled by the remaining anger that claims this was merely a fraction of what he deserves, of what is inside me right now, of what this world deserves. It's Lara who breaks the silence, which has grown so thick, so heavy, that I'm almost amazed anything can penetrate it. I shouldn't have come, she says quickly, slithering down from the stool. I really think you two need to talk and— No, stay. Please stay. I put out a hand to keep her there, still focusing on the wine glass. I'm sorry. I take a deep breath and look up at her. She's half turned to go, uncertainty and concern in her eyes. I'm resolutely not looking at Tom, but I know he's watching us, watching me mostly. I can feel it on my skin, through my skin even, like a pressure on my bones. It's not that, anyway, it's— What? She asks. My life, my business, really is getting trampled. There are rumors in the market that I'm about to be arrested for murder, I say miserably. Mark Jeffers, this associate candidate at— Well, never mind where he's at. Anyway, he told Paul. And if he told Paul, of all people, how do I know he's not telling the whole world? Lara sits down again, accompanied by a sharp intake of breath. We all know this isn't the sole reason for my abysmal lack of composure, or even the main reason for it, but they're both kind enough to tacitly redirect their attention. Tom finally speaks his first words since my outburst.
How did Paul react? Do you think he will jump ship?
I feel my mouth twist sourly. How typical of Tom to be able to set aside my diatribe and focus. It forces me to respond with a civility I still don't feel. I don't know. I don't think so. Not yet, anyway. We've got two very prestigious contracts. But if the rumors escalate and we lose one of those, then yes, he's Paul. He'd jump ship. I shrug. He was upset I hadn't told him about it. I take a sip of the wine, then look at both of them curiously. Have you guys told anyone about all of this? Tom shakes his head.
It's hardly something I want to bring up on the trading floor. I can just imagine the fun they'd have.
He grimaces, no doubt imagining the taunts that would inevitably haunt him for the rest of his career. As a mob crowd, traders are not known for their sensitivity.
And I don't want to worry my folks. I'm not sure Seb has mentioned it to his parents either, unless it's to get a recommendation of a lawyer from his dad.
I spoke to a couple of girls at work, says Lara, but never any details. I certainly didn't mention your name, if that's what you're— I shake my head. God no, I was just curious. Curious as to whether my reluctance to talk about it is another sign of too much solitude, or actually perfectly normal.
Tom is still analyzing. His eyes are fixed on the falling darkness outside the kitchen window as he scratches his head thoughtfully.
The clouds are now inky smudges against a marginally paler sky.
And this chap, Mark Jenners, Jeffers. Mark Jeffers told Paul you were about to be arrested.
So I understand. Tom is frowning.
Just you.
I shrug.
Maybe it's nothing but Chinese whispers, but it seems a bit odd. You couldn't put it together from just the newspaper articles, I don't think. Our names have never been mentioned.
I nod. That's what I thought. Lara's cheeks are flushed, and her eyelids a little droopy. The glass or two that she had earlier, plus the large one Tom poured for her, are taking their toll.
Big mouth for a lawyer, she comments, finishing in a cat-like yawn that she neatly smothers.
Aren't they supposed to be discreet? And aren't you supposed to butter up your headhunting firm, not spread scurrilous rumors about them? I can't imagine this is you and Paul dying to find him a good placement.
It's another of Lara's unexpectedly perceptive moments, though she hasn't followed through to the implications.
Tom's gaze and mine jump to lock together, and for a moment it's like the darkened corridor never happened, like I've never ever doubted him, and I can see exactly what he's thinking.
But who? I say to him. I don't know.
Tom shakes his head, then frowns again.
I can't see who could possibly benefit.
Who what? asks Lara, thoroughly lost.
Who put him up to it? I explain. You're right. It's extremely